This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Colonel Ann B. Smith. Today's date is the 21st of June, 2005. I am in the upstairs offices of the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech, and the Colonel is speaking to me by telephone from her home in Alabama. Good morning again, Ann. We've been speaking for a little while, but I want to thank you again for your time today.
It's nice to be talking to you again.
Ann, let's start where we left off, which is in 1973, your assignment to teach at the Command and General Staff College in Fort Leavenworth. Can you tell me how that posting came about? And certainly there were some special things about that posting.
Sometime before that, my assignment officer called and asked if I would be interested in going to teach at Leavenworth. They had finally decided that they wanted to have a woman on the faculty. And I said yes, and it never went anywhere. And so as time passed, I realized that my boss and I were never going to get along with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to get out of that assignment because I was not doing myself any good, and I certainly was not doing Army women any good because his opinion of them was based on our not getting along. Now, I realize it's my responsibility to get along with him, not his to get along with me.
Right.
And when that happens, you do your best to get away from it to make it better for everybody. So I called Colonel Shirley Hines and said, I need to get out of here, and is there any chance that opportunity at Leavenworth is still open? And she checked and called back and said yes. And so that's how I wound up on my way to Leavenworth.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, as the first woman instructor after World War II?
Yes, there had been one during World War II, and that was the situation, that I was the first since then.
And did any other women join the faculty while you were there?
Yes. Now, there were women on the support staff.
Yes.
Quite a few of them, but a logistician came in while I was there.
Do you remember her name?
Charlotte Phillips.
And what can you tell me about her? Did you two kind of club up, or?
No.
She was in a different area?
I was in the Department of Command, and she was in the Department of Logistics.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew she was there, and I can't remember how far it was into my tour that she came, but we didn't have a large overlap. And, of course, there were always women students at the college.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What was your relationship with the women students who might have come through your classes? Did they kind of look up to you, do you think?
No, we'd all known each other before.
Mm. Oh, okay. So there was no...
I was a lieutenant colonel. They were majors and lieutenant colonels.
Okay.
And our paths had crossed considerably.
Okay. So there was no danger of them holding you up on a... putting you up on a pedestal.
No.
What about the male students? Of course, there were hundreds and hundreds of men, I would think, in each class. Is that accurate?
Of course, they had mixed feelings about me, but I taught in an area that, it wasn't like sending me in to teach tactics.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I felt, generally well received. I did not feel any animosity from the students. I was there and a part of the system.
Mm-hmm. What about other instructors in the department? How did you kind of mesh with them?
I had a grand time with them. It happened that one of the men who had taught me when I was a student was on the faculty,
mm-hmm,
with me, and he had sort of made the path comfortable for me because he thought a lot of me, and I had a sponsor and a supporter on my way in.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people in the Department of Command was an odd mix of people. The chaplain, who was always assigned to Leavenworth, was in that department.
Okay.
And we talked about, we talked things like leadership and personnel management and things like that. So it was the soft skills,
mm-hmm.
and not the hard ones. So that made a difference.
Was the curriculum already set for you when you arrived?
Oh, yes.
And how did you familiarize yourself to the point where you felt comfortable teaching, or did you already have everything you needed in terms of expertise and background?
No, I didn't have everything I needed, but they had very comprehensive lesson plans already prepared, and I was told that under a previous commandant, that if he opened three doors, he expected everybody to be saying exactly the same thing.
Wow.
I could not have taught under those conditions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't memorize. I teach from cards.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not my style to do rote stuff.
Right. And who was the commandant at this time?
Right this minute, he's completely lost. I'll come up with it.
Oh, that's okay.
I mean, he was a major general.
You mentioned that there was this one fellow who had been an instructor when you were a student there who made things a little bit easier. Can you tell me anything more about him?
Well, specifically nothing unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And he left shortly after I got there. But the group in that department was very welcoming. And I made friends with a lot of people in the other departments, too, because I'm gregarious. also garrulous.
Garrulous, yes. you mentioned to me last year, in fact, that... There was some...
The general's name was Cushman.
There you go. See, you knew it would come to you.
Yes.
You mentioned last year when we were talking about some of these things that there was at least some undercurrent every once in a while, a suggestion that you were some kind of token.
One of the women on the staff
mm-hmm.
told me one day, and this had upset her dreadfully, some man had said that token up in command. I said, well, I am. I'm the only one here. So certainly I'm a token. You don't have to take it pejoratively.
She was upset because she had taken it pejoratively.
Yes, she thought I was being criticized. Well, maybe I was, but I wasn't going to take it that way.
And you mentioned to me that you had coined a term around this experience.
Yeah, minority paranoia.
Yeah, can you explain what you mean by that?
I think that people who are put in that position can let themselves feel that they're carrying the weight of their kind on their shoulders.
In other words, you're the representative of this group?
Yes.
And you bear responsibility?
And the men, I don't think, suffer that. If there were an infantryman there who was not a good instructor, he'd just be a poor instructor.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had not been reasonably good, all women would have been judged by me. I believe that.
And is that because you were sort of the first one to hold this job? Is that an essential to it, or is it because the Army itself is obviously structured, in such a way as to have greater representation of men than women?
No, it wasn't that. It was that I put myself in the position of any minority
mm-hmm.
who is sort of carrying the flag
mm-hmm.
in any endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're the first, you... This may not be a general conception. It may be a personal thing that I came up with. But I always want to do a good job. But I did want to do a good job so that other women would not be judged by me as being bad because I was a woman.
And
it wasn't the system that did it to me. Mm-hmm. This is internal.
Did you, I'm sensing, Ann, that you felt this way at the time. This isn't a retrospective thing. You felt
this
way.
No, I felt that way at the time.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, 1973 was really kind of a spiking point for the beginnings of what we now call the women's movement in this country. Did you feel kind of, you know, any extra burden because of that? Because of the, no?
No. What one advantage I had was that I had been to Vietnam.
Why was that an advantage?
Because it was a mark of belonging, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
You'd been to Vietnam.
So you had some credibility as a result?
I think so.
Okay. People, students and faculty members sort of had to take you with a little more grit, a little more substance?
I think because that was, you know, that was the card everybody needed to get punched.
Mm-hmm.
And not a lot of women were there.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I had the ribbons to prove it.
tell me a little bit more about the curriculum. Were you teaching a particular class or more than one class?
I taught everything, if I can recall, I taught everything that our department taught.
Wow.
But more than anything, I taught in the personnel management and in those leadership things like motivation and discipline. And we taught the drug and alcohol stuff. And
how important was, for example, that element in the curriculum as you encountered it?
Oh, I think it was considered. Sometimes the people in command called us the red stain upstairs because we had all the touchy-feely things.
They called you the red stain?
As in communism.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's kind of, I mean, that would have just all been in jest, I'm sure.
Yep. But as I said, we had the chaplain, mm-hmm. we had the lawyer, we had all of the, and we had a lot of combat arms. My boss was an infantryman,
mm-hmm.
but still we were, the AG officer, all of the non-combat arms, and the the logistics was just full of logisticians and those sorts of things.
Let me ask you, if you mentioned drug and alcohol issues were part of what you had to teach. Was there also a component that dealt with race differences?
Oh, yes. That was an interesting thing. The,
mm-hmm.
The classrooms had 50 or so people in them, and for a lot of the work, we divided them into about 15-person work groups.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were teaching racial harmony, for lack of a better word, mm-hmm. and awareness and sensitivity, we were divided into different categories, and the instructors were. And by ethnic groups or different groups. And my particular group was the Appalachians, and how people from Appalachia and people who think like that, how you have to deal with them in a structured environment.
Mm-hmm.
Because when fishing season starts, they're ready to go fishing.
Mm-hmm.
And a different lifestyle completely. So we had African-Americans, Appalachians, American Indians. I can't remember all of the groups, but it was interesting because of the readings we did that gave us a different slant on how people think,
mm-hmm.
and how you have to deal with them in a controlled environment.
Overall, do you think the way the curriculum was structured on that issue was a helpful approach? Do you think it accomplished the purpose?
Well, I think it might have made him think a little bit.
Okay. And that's probably a pretty good outcome, actually, rather than just blowing through and not, you know, not taking it in at all.
In one group I had, we had a Catholic priest, and we were talking about ways of changing behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking about aversion therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kept talking about it and talking about it. And all of a sudden, he had an absolutely aha experience, because what he had heard me saying was virgin therapy.
So clarity broke through.
And we looked at the Milgram tape,
mm-hmm,
and those types of things. So it was during an era of being more, I don't know how to describe it.
It was a time different than this one, that's certain.
Yeah, and at the time I could have told you the differences, but we were into motivation and trying to understand why,
mm-hmm,
and which was probably needed after coming down from Vietnam.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about that, because your station, your duty at Fort Leavenworth actually encompassed a time period that, you know, everything in Vietnam changed. You started there in 1973 and
yeah,
went there until 75. And I wonder if, for example, you remember the release of the POWs and the conclusion of the Paris peace talks and then the release of American POWs.
Specifically, I can't say.
Okay. I know later.
Because sometimes I get my student year mixed up with my being there,
mm-hmm,
here,
mm-hmm,
by 2.5 years as a faculty. Back to being, if you will, the token, it was,
mm-hmm,
very interesting that frequently the commanding general would put me on a committee. And invariably he had me and the Marine representative, who was a Marine colonel. And I think he wanted a more forthright opinion than he would get from some people.
Mm-hmm.
I made him very mad one day.
What did you do?
He asked something, and I gave him my honest answer, and he just thought I was wrong. I mean, he couldn't accept what I told him that I thought I saw, because,
mm-hmm,
he didn't want to believe it.
Do you remember what the circumstances were?
I don't remember.
But he just was shocked, probably.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but it was a very interesting sort of relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, in some way, he probably had a difficult, slightly complicated duty to discharge too, which was to oversee the work of the first woman on the faculty.
Well, I was so far removed from him.
Mm-hmm.
Truly, I wasn't on his screen at all, other than when he wanted some different people to look at an issue.
Uh-huh. And then you were drafted into that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He made drastic changes in the way the school operated, and it very resented by the students often and the faculty.
What kinds of changes?
Well, he decided that we had the Army had too much grade distortion. Everybody expected to have an A, and he decided that we weren't going to award that X percent of A's.
Oh,
and
boy,
that means you got to make a hard decision.
Mm-hmm.
And the students resented that highly, because they've been told they're the top 50% of the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And they believed it. So to come have someone come in with, everybody was used to getting A's on assignment, and for us to be told we couldn't give but one, and for them to be told only one was going to get it, now that's cutthroat.
Yeah, yeah, it sets up some very difficult dynamics.
And you get students who didn't do too well going and complaining to their faculty advisors, who were then going to the instructors. We were all in the same boat.
Sure, sure.
But it was difficult.
Well, were you? How did you feel when your tour there came to its end? Were you glad you'd had the opportunity?
Oh yes, mm-hmm. And I had intended to retire from there.
In 1975?
Around there.
Uh-huh. What was your thinking about retirement?
Well, I was a lieutenant colonel. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any hope of getting to be a colonel. Mm-hmm. And I had, by that time, over 20 years service. And I thought, you know, thinking back, that I probably couldn't get a better assignment than that.
And what changed your mind?
I got a better assignment.
At this point as a lieutenant colonel, were you speaking with people in personnel about what might be available, or were you kind of sailing on your own, thinking, yes, I'll retire, and then something kind of cropped up?
Yeah.
Okay.
And at the time when it popped up, I was talking to the deputy commandant at a party. And he said, oh, you should definitely take the assignment. And it's still going on now, mm-hmm. We had a command selection process. And I had not been selected for command. And so that tells you something. Mm-hmm. If you're not selected for command, you're probably not going any further. Mm-hmm. It doesn't assure that you're going any further, but it opens the door for it.
Okay.
And somebody who had been selected to command one of the training battalions at Fort McClellan turned it down, and they offered it to me.
Hmm.
And that made perfect sense to me, that at least it was an opportunity. Plus, I thought of it as a challenge and a good assignment, because I enjoy training troops.
And so you left Fort Leavenworth for McClellan in 1975.
Yes.
Do you know roughly when you arrived there at McClellan?
In the summer.
In the summer. And how long did you expect you would be there? A year or?
I didn't have any anticipation of how long I would be there.
Okay.
That's where I was going. And that's what I was going to do.
Now, did a consideration for promotion accompany the command post?
Well, I would be considered at the normal time for consideration.
Okay.
It didn't give me any leg up on early consideration. It was just as the time that I should be considered. But I knew, and everybody in the Army knows, that command is greatly to be desired.
Yes. It's crucial for getting on up the line.
Yes.
Tell me about your year then at Fort McClellan as commander of the 1st Women's Army Corps Training Battalion.
It was a grand year. I had a good time. I enjoyed training troops. I worked with good people.
Mm-hmm.
Had good people in the battalion, the company commanders and first sergeants and my boss. It was just a good time. It was fun. I mean, there were some rough spots.
Mm-hmm.
But
who was your commanding officer?
Colonel Shirley Hines.
And what was her position?
She was the WAC Center commander.
Okay. And how many training battalions were there?
When I first got there, there were three.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of them closed out, and we had two. Back in the olden days, when I was first assigned there as a lieutenant, we only had one training battalion, and it was the one I was commanding. So I went home.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like it must have been in some way, you know, kind of feeling full, a little bit of full circle feeling that you were back at McClellan.
Yep.
How had it changed? I know you'd been in and out of there, but you started there in 1953.
Well, we had so many more troops that undergoing training. The curriculum was different. When I was a student officer, we got to fire a carbine for familiarization. When I was there as a battalion commander, they were firing M1 for qualification.
Wow.
And the commanding general of the post had somehow staked his reputation on how well the women did on the range, and he was determined that no matter how long you had to stay out there, you would have a large number of women qualified. There was pressure.
This was his thing.
Yes.
His emphasis. What was his name? This was the commander of Fort McClellan?
Kingston.
Okay.
There were two Kingstons in the Army, brothers. He was one of them.
And these are both very senior people.
He was a brigadier general.
Mm-hmm. You said that there were some rough patches, too. Do you remember any of those that you can share, or what the circumstances were?
Well, he threatened to court-martial me one time.
Okay, well, that's pretty rough.
That's rough.
That qualifies. What was going on with that?
We were having probably a reunion, a WAC reunion, or something that was a big do.
Mm-hmm.
And the 14th Army Band, which was the only all-women's band in the world, at that military band at that time, was being disbanded. And they were going to play a final concert. And they had a male warrant officer as their commander. But always before it, there had been a woman commanding the band.
Mm-hmm.
So they were scheduled for the performance to start at 8 o'clock. I was standing out back waiting for General Kingston to come. He was never on time for anything. And so at 8 o'clock, the band started because nobody was there. I was out back. Oh, I was the officer in charge of this whole fracas. So I was out waiting for the general, and the band started. And he was furious. And I made the serious mistake, this was a Friday night, of saying to his aide, well, the general's always late.
Oops.
It was bad enough that they'd started without him, because that was my fault too, of course. Mm-hmm. But then saying something like that, and Saturday morning, Shirley Hines called me and said, what did you do to the general? He wants to see you first thing Monday morning. So first thing Monday morning, I was in his office, and the aide and the secretary had disappeared.
So
just left.
Just you and him?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And thank goodness he had practiced what he wanted to say to me, and he knew it real well, and it didn't take but about 5 minutes. He had been known to speak off the cuff for a lot longer than that. And when it happened to me, everybody said, don't worry, it's happened to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
That's a personality quirk of his.
Mm-hmm.
And they had just sent in a special efficiency report on me that was going before the promotion board. And he threatened me with withdrawing that efficiency report and said he ought to court-martial me.
And
for disloyalty.
For disloyalty to him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when he finished, I said, is that all, sir? Thank you, sir. Saluted, about-faced, and got out of there as fast as I possibly could.
Did you think there would be serious repercussions?
I didn't know. It would have surprised me if he had withdrawn that efficiency report. And if he had, that was the report the only report I had for command.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, it could have been very... I didn't know I was going to get promoted. It surprised me when I did. But I certainly wouldn't have if he had withdrawn that efficiency report.
It's, I mean, in hindsight, do you see that as an important turning point, or as he gave you a kick in the pants and that's about it?
Well, he didn't carry through on it.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been a very important turning point if he carried through on it.
When were you actually promoted to colonel?
76.
Okay. And?
And that's why I had to leave 1st Battalion. Because it was a lieutenant colonel slot, and so I couldn't stay. I asked to stay, but they said, no, you can't.
Well, what did they have in the way of possibilities for you as a newly minted colonel?
I stayed on post.
To do what?
There was a group called the Headquarters Command that had the MPs and the support troops, and we had a transportation battalion, supply and transportation battalion on post at time, and they were all part of headquarters command, and I was commander of it.
So approximately how many personnel were you responsible for in this new position?
We had one MP company and a headquarters company and the battalion, which was, I have no idea how many people were in it. We had two MP companies, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a nice little bunch of people.
And you got to stay at McClellan, as you've said.
Yeah.
Was that important to you, to be able to stay there?
I was glad to stay. And they didn't have any place for me at the time to put me. So,
mm-hmm.
So it was fortuitous that that position was available.
Were there issues that came up that kind of tested your abilities at that in that position? Any difficulties arise that you can tell us about, or command decisions that you had to take?
Only one big one, and I don't want to talk about it.
Okay, sure. You were there from 1976 to 1978.
Yeah.
And were you again giving thought to possibly retiring at this point?
Well, you're always sort of thinking about it,
mm-hmm.
but the colonel's branch called me one day and offered me a chance to go to, I've forgotten where, Germany, I think, and I said, I really don't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Called back one day and said, we want you to go to Bayonne, New Jersey. I said, I surely do not want to go to Bayonne, New Jersey.
That just wasn't very appealing at all.
Well, the third time,
mm-hmm.
he said, we have an assignment for you in Washington. I don't want to go to Washington. He says, well, the pachyderms have decided. Either you go or you retire. I said, I'll go.
Now, when he said the pachyderms, did for someone who didn't get that reference, what did you understand that to mean?
Well, the big boys.
The big boys.
Yes.
So they had decided this was your third pitch, and
uh-huh.
you could swing and hit it or not. But if
and there was an assignment that was open and that I fit the qualifications for, at least on paper.
And this position, I'm looking at the notes that you provided, was Director of Casualty and Memorial Affairs for the Army.
Yeah.
In
the Office of the Adjutant General.
Okay. Where were you stationed?
In the Forrestal Building.
Which is
right across, it's across the street from the mall, from the Smithsonian.
Oh, okay.
Out of my window, I could see the Freer Gallery. And what's more, I had windows on two sides.
This sounds okay.
I mean, that is something.
Yeah,
people would come in my office and say, how did you get this? I said, it came with a job.
Well, tell me about the work there as the director of this office. What things did you have within your responsibility area?
One of the first responsibilities we had at that time, we were the office of record of all prisoners of war and missing in action. Their personnel records were in my office as opposed to the normal place you would have them. And at the time, we were still having hearings on determination of missing in action, whether to declare them as dead or continue them on the Army rolls. And it was during Korea, when you were captured, your life stopped. If you were captured as a captain, you came out as a captain with no accumulated time.
Mm-hmm.
In Vietnam, if you were captured or MIA, your whole career continued.
Your career clock, essentially.
You continued to gain longevity. You got raises as your cohort got raises.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big consideration because many of the families, it was, well, there were several reasons. Some of them were monetary. Others were just absolute family tie. They wanted an answer.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, where is my son dead? Are you still looking for him? Those types of things. For some of the, particularly some of the wives, they wanted to get on with their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But there were people who were shot down or captured maybe as captains, and then by the time Vietnam was over, they'd been promoted to colonels because all their contemporaries had been.
Yeah.
So it was interesting, and we were having hearings, and they were in my office complex.
Mm-hmm. Now, were these public hearings? Could anyone attend, or family members?
No,
or?
Family members, any mm-hmm. family members who wanted to, and we had a hearing officer. But the problem, the onus was on the family to prove that the person was alive. And that's hard to do.
Impossible.
Yeah. But that was one of the important things that we did. Probably the most important thing we did was take care of soldiers who, in one sense, take care of soldiers who died or who were seriously ill. All of the death reports came into our office, and we had sergeants who maintained contact with the families. We were in contact with them on getting the remains home. And
mm-hmm.
if somebody was seriously ill, I mean, by the doctors determined seriously ill, we were giving the families daily reports.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hard work, but it was rewarding work because the people were doing something, and doing something that was important to somebody. So that I think, was one of the most important things that office did.
Would you speak with family members when they were in the building on various
business? They didn't come into the building very much. We also oversaw Arlington Cemetery. And the other, there were three cemeteries that did not revert to the VA when the VA took over most of the cemeteries. Arlington National Cemetery, the cemetery at the Soldiers Home, in a cemetery at West Point.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a shared responsibility with the Corps of Engineers for the maintenance and upkeep and all of that at those three cemeteries. So that was a fascinating part of the job.
Yeah, tell me about what kind of things you had to oversee as far as, for example, Arlington affairs.
Well, the Adjutant General's office was responsible for the budget.
Mm-hmm.
So that was probably one of the more important things, because we had to, it had to be defended before Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a little while to learn that when you're presenting the president's budget, you must present it as if you like it.
Mm-hmm. As if it is your own.
Yes, mm-hmm. And you're not permitted to say, but we really need $1 million for roads, which I did one day, in essence.
Did you?
Yeah. I had not understood the rules.
Uh-huh.
And I got sort of sandbagged, but be that as it may, I told them what I thought.
Now, was this up on the Hill somewhere?
Yeah.
So you were actually up there testifying?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
To a committee.
Mm-hmm. And you told them that maybe there were some repairs that need to be done?
Yeah.
Oops. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I found out how much a mile of road cost when I was in that job. And the superintendent of the cemetery let me think he worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, it's such a prestige place. And I learned a good bit. One of the things I did that I was proud of, most of the people who worked for me were civilians. And most of them had never seen a military funeral. So I arranged to have some training time for them.
Mm-hmm.
I called it training. And the cemetery sent its bus over, and we let them see a funeral. Because that's what they were dealing with.
Did you yourself go over on any regular basis over to Arlington?
Fairly regular. I had a permanent visitor's pass, so I didn't have to worry about
mm-hmm.
getting in and finding a place to park. And a lot of people want to go to Arlington. And so frequently on the weekends, if somebody was visiting and had never seen it, we'd go over.
Mm-hmm.
But I went over on a fairly regular basis just to talk to them and see what was going on. And when the president would lay a wreath, I would certainly have to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I had a fleeting thought, and it fled.
That's right. Maybe we'll get that one back. Can you describe the protocols for being able to be buried at Arlington, at least as they were when you were there? Do you remember those?
Generally.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who honorably retired, could be buried there.
Mm-hmm.
And veterans who had the Purple Heart or the Silver Star or higher could be buried. Spouses, adult, dependent children,
mm-hmm.
and then other people as determined by the president.
Were there any particular burials that you remember during that period that you attended?
The chief of cemeteries for the VA died, and I went to his funeral because there were the close ties between us and them, that we worked together
mm-hmm.
a good bit.
Oh, sure.
And it's the prettiest casket I have ever seen. I would have used it, loved to have had it in my living room as an end table or a coffee table. It was mahogany. It's just gorgeous.
Of course, Arlington is a hugely moving place in the American mind, I think. Did you feel a special sense of responsibility, some kind of important
Oh, certainly. It's feeling. A national monument, mm-hmm. for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, I was on a committee with a general who had never been to Arlington.
Mm.
So I asked him if he'd like to tour And one Sunday I picked him up and took him over, and we were on one of those high spots where all you look out and see is markers. And he said, "All those graves." And it was just, it really hit him. And there's some wonderful things about Arlington. The superintendent used to have a picnic on the 4th of July, and you would go out in front of the Lee Custis house and watch fireworks.
Mm-hmm.
What my fleeting was, when President Carter was president, and they had a memorial service for some group, and I cannot remember which one it was, but it was in the amphitheater, and everybody was there, the Supreme Court, a bunch of senators, and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But my memory of it, my greatest memory, it was an Air Force, I think, quartet who sang "Precious Lord, Hold My Hand." And it was absolutely, they were singing a cappella.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, while they were singing, a bird started chirping along with them. And at the end, the president says, "All I can think of to say is amen." And it was such a touching moment, mm-hmm. event. And General Marshall died just as I was retiring, and I was on leave. And I was really sorry because I never saw a big funeral. And that's probably the last truly big one there will be.
General Marshall, Secretary of State.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry, misspoke. Omar Bradley.
Oh, Omar Bradley. Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And my office had the funeral plans. And about once a year, you pulled out the plans and reviewed them to be sure that they were correct.
And that you were ready.
Yeah.
In case
that the Army was ready. I mean, the Military District of Washington was very much involved in things at Arlington because the troops belong to them, the old guard.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Last year you mentioned when we were talking that on occasion when you were going to work, you encountered protesters. Do you remember that?
Oh, good grief, yes.
What can you tell me about that?
Well, they were frequently around the Pentagon, and it made it hard to get into the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
But outside, I was in the same office as the nuclear energy people.
Mm-hmm.
And so some people decided they didn't like them, and so they blocked our doors, and we had to go in roundabout. We couldn't go in the front door, and we had to go in roundabout. And they were staying out there trying to give us things. And one of them, and I didn't take it, and one of them said, "Don't you think I have a right to say what I believe?" I said, "Yeah, and I have a right not to read it." But the big thing was the year the farmers came to Washington on all their tractors.
Mm-hmm. 1980, I think.
And they blocked our driveways, mm-hmm. so we couldn't take our cars in. And so people parked on the street, and then the police towed them away or gave them tickets. That was fun.
Did you just kind of take these things in stride?
You didn't have much choice.
Did you ever feel threatened?
No. And I could sit. There was a parking, the entrance to the parking deck was outside one of my windows, and I could watch what was going on a lot of times. And we would, one time, I don't know which group it was, but they were all lying down in the driveway.
Mm-hmm.
So the police would come and pick them up by the feet and pull them off, and then come back. and lie down again. The police would pull them off. So they were persistent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I was also there when the Christians came, and it was one of those first big gatherings of fundamentalist Christians,
mm-hmm.
and they were over on the mall. And the lieutenant colonel who worked with me and I were walking around and watching all of them, you know, just observing. And this woman came up to me, us, because we were the only thing in uniform, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
She said, "I can't find my group." We said, "Well, what group were you with?" "I was with the New York group, and I can't find them." We said, "Well, why don't you look for Banner and see if you can find them?"
That was helpful.
And then we were there. I was there when the Pope came.
Yeah, tell me about that experience.
Well, he was on the mall, and, I mean, he was going to appear on the mall.
Mm-hmm.
And we went over and during the week and watched them put up the platform and all that sort of thing. And I asked a good Roman Catholic friend of mine if she was going down to see the Pope. She said, "No, I'm going to watch on television. I can see better." So I decided that's what I'd do too.
Mm-hmm. But certainly his arrival there had to have been a huge event.
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
And I was there during Reagan's first inauguration. It was a gorgeous day. It was warm and sunny. And so this same friend and I caught the metro and went in to see that. And we perched on a lamppost along the parade route. It was funny because they had some little fancy designs that we could stand on.
So you just climbed up and...
Yeah. Stood up and watched the parade.
Do you know about where you were on Pennsylvania Avenue?
Probably not far from the MARTA station, if there is one. I really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was right on the parade route.
Mm-hmm. So I take it you had no official duties that day. You were on your own.
I was on my own. I thought later, I wish I'd volunteered to march in the parade, because that would have been, it'd have been a long walk, but
yes.
It would have been a memorable experience.
You were there nonetheless.
Yeah, I was
mm-hmm.
there.
You stayed until, the president was inaugurated in January of 81, so soon after that, did you come to the point where you decided that you were in fact going to retire?
I had been in that job for 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
There was somebody else waiting in the wings for it, and I could have stayed 2 more years. But I didn't want to be somebody for whom they had to find a make-work job.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a good indication to me it was time to retire.
Did you have some mixed feelings about going toward that, the end of your military career? I mean, you say you could have easily stayed in that position for another couple of years if circumstances had allowed.
Well, I wouldn't have been in that position, and I didn't really want anything else. There are a lot of jobs you can just sort of fill time in,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't want one of those because I'd had a very rewarding time in that job. Interesting things happened,
mm-hmm.
and it was a challenging job and enjoyable. It sounds awful to say you enjoyed dealing with things we did, but it was. And it was a good time. A good friend of mine said, when she retired, she said, "I want to do it on my terms."
Mm-hmm.
And I agreed with her. I don't want them to tell me I have to retire. And it was a good time.
And certainly a high point. I mean, you've indicated how important you felt this work was, and that you had had a hand in you know, really important things, the POW MIA resolution issues. During that time, did anything come up with regard to relations with Vietnam, with Hanoi, the government in Hanoi?
Not for me.
Okay.
Now, we had the Central Identification Laboratory in Hawaii, where all the identifications were made, was a part of my office.
Okay.
And we had the mortuary in Dover, Delaware, and in Oakland that were also a part of the activities of my office. So that was an interesting part, too, because mm-hmm. you asked me if I ever talked to parents. Every now and then some irate mother would call, and I would get her.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And one day Mrs. Smith called, and Mrs. Smith was very unhappy because some of her son's possessions had not been sent home. Among them were illegal weapons, but I specifically remember that his dingo boots did not come home with his possessions.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how I don't remember how he had died, but she was very irate and just berating me because, and I was not being mad at her. I was just, Mrs. Smith, I understand. And finally, she said to me, "Nobody gives a shit about my son. Nobody cares." I said, "I care, Mrs. Smith, and I am listening to you."
Mm-hmm.
And then another retired sergeant, master sergeant, called, and the Army had turned down. His son had shot himself in the head playing Russian roulette.
Mm-hmm.
His son was an MP, and the Army had ruled that his injury was due to his own misconduct. He should have known enough not to hold a weapon to his head, especially as an MP.
Mm-hmm.
But he was permanently handicapped.
Sure.
And disabled. And the sergeant thought the Army ought to reverse the finding. And it had been reviewed by the judge advocate. It had been reviewed by everybody. But he was one I talked to. Sometimes I'd be in the office late and I'd pick up the phone. But anyway, he threatened to go to 60 Minutes, all the things
mm-hmm.
to get some attention for his son's case. And I told him about the Army Board for Correction of Military Records. And I said, "That is your only recourse because they can change anything." He'd never heard of it.
Really?
Well, as much as he didn't like what we were doing, he would call me every now and then to ask for advice.
Hmm.
And that was an interesting turn
mm-hmm.
on things, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd dealt with people on paper, but it was still dealing with human lives.
You know, and crucial national issues that obviously continue even down to the present day.
Well, there was a fire in the embassy in Pakistan during that time, and an Army warrant officer was killed. And that was very difficult because all of his records were in the same building with him. So it was almost impossible to do an identification.
Hmm.
And the only thing we had, we couldn't find his dental records, we couldn't find a civilian dentist, nothing. But he had very crooked teeth. And when they were described to his wife, she said that she identified him from that. She accepted the identification from
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of those cases that got all sorts of interest mm-hmm. from the pachyderms.
Mm-hmm. So you had, these are difficult issues for you to negotiate, too.
Well, the sergeants who worked for me worked with that sort of stuff all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But that one got high-level interest.
Was that so, because, what was the reason?
Well, because it was in Pakistan, and because it was a military man, and there was a fire, and the generals decided that they had to manage it.
They couldn't, they had to get involved in that one.
Uh-huh. And the sergeants would have done it a lot more efficiently.
Well, Anne, as you think back on your career, and this has come up a couple times, but I wonder how you feel about your service in Vietnam in the context of everything else that you did. Was it something that you... still think was an important part of your career path?
Yes, I think it was, because at the time, it was where the action was.
Mm-hmm.
It was a strange time. I mean, you don't go out and drink coffee on the top of one of the biggest hotels in Saigon and watch the artillery flares from beyond.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an unreal sort of life. War was all around, but it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt particularly frightened. It was not the most rewarding assignment I ever had, but I'm glad I had it.
Mm-hmm. How do you view the Vietnam conflict generally? I mean, is this something you've given much thought to, whether the United States...
You can't help but think of it now.
Mm-hmm. Because of Iraq?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And because of how we don't learn.
Can you say a little more about that? What do you mean?
There are different wars. They're totally different wars. But we still seem to fail to think of the consequences. It seemed to me, since I'm such a tactician and strategist,
mm-hmm. You are, actually,
that it was ridiculous to think that they were going to welcome us with open arms,
mm-hmm.
and in Iraq and be so glad to have us, and that we didn't plan for anything that happened after we got there and won. For example, having no security for such things as their treasures, their museums, and... we are, it seems to me, totally oblivious of other people's cultures. Ours is so good, we have to give it to everybody. And I'm not being un-American or unpatriotic. I just think we are not realistic.
About our planning for another nation and its development? And
by assuming... Mm-hmm. That because we have it, they want it. They may want some of us, but they don't want us superimposed upon them. I just finished reading a book called The Battle for God, and it's about fundamentalism in Protestant Christianity, Islam, and in among the Jews. And the roots of fundamentalism.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is people's not understanding other cultures. Fascinating book.
And so by this lack of understanding, they then become intolerant and then have to do something about the culture they can't tolerate, something like that?
Yeah. And that a lot of fundamentalism, and this isn't just in religion, I think, is because people can't deal with change.
Mm-hmm.
They don't adjust to it well, and they want to hold on to what was, and modernization is an anathema. So there. That's my big word for the day.
Well,
and that's off the track.
It's an interesting sort of commentary, because it does have to do with why there's so much, for example, public support for the American mission in Iraq, Operation Iraqi Freedom.
I think everybody, almost without exception, would support the soldiers and want them success.
Mm-hmm.
But the policy is another thing. And I think the policy was foisted upon us, and we may have become a little bit more jaded about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I may be speaking only for myself. Well, I have become more jaded, but I never was very unjaded.
And you know, I wonder if you can kind of draw any parallels between the fact that you were in Vietnam in 1970, which many historians and as well as command personnel who were there think was a turning point year, when the United States had sort of won part of the war but couldn't figure out how to meet the needs of domestic complaint about the length of the war, and couldn't figure out how essentially to get out of South Vietnam and leave it as a functional and secure entity. And I wonder if, you see that we're having sort of some of the same problems in Iraq. We can't really figure out how to get out, leaving a functional and secure political entity behind us.
Well, I think we have, in both cases, we certainly underestimated our enemy and helped create some of our enemies. Mm-hmm. But I'm not a deep enough thinker to draw large conclusions.
I think you've done pretty well. Anne, is there anything that I haven't asked you about in the course of the interview that you've been thinking, gosh, I hope she asks me something on that topic?
You've been ahead of me all the way.
Well, Anne, I want to thank you very much for the time that you've taken and that you've invested in this oral history interview and all the insights that you've contributed and you've done so very freely, and I want to thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. I've enjoyed it.